Good day, and welcome to The State of Us on True Chat Broadcasting from Studio 2A in Cincinnati, Ohio. I'm Justin T. Webb.
And I'm Cam Pierce.
As always, thank you very much for tuning in to today's show. A little bit of good news today, always a refresher. Iraq is celebrating a win in Mosul as rifts widen. Exciting stuff, huh, Cam?
Yeah, except for that last part.
Right, except for the back part. So with good news, there must come bad news. But we'll focus on the good, at least for a minute. As many of you who currently tune into this show on a regular basis know, we are trying our best to continue to cover conflicts in the Middle East, specifically the Syrian Civil War, which is now at day 2,310. So as that continues to progress, we do encourage you to learn more about it, to obviously tune in, of course, to The State of Us, because we try our best to cover it when we feel that it's appropriate to do so. But in the in-between periods, you're welcome to visit imsyria.org or Google the Violations Documentation Center. So the fighting is all but over in Mosul, and the billboards are already up. Heavily raised signs in which the government urged the city's Sunni residents to, quote, turn the page from the terrorists of the Islamic State. So that's what's going on right now. It is a big win, obviously, and that's according to the New York Times on Tuesday, July 11th, 2017, for Iraq, which, as some of you have heard in other news, the U.S. has officially turned over security of the nation to the Iraq forces, which is a big deal as well.
Mm-hmm.
Big step forward in the long-standing conflict there. But there's a lot of important questions that are looming. So this is another military win. But you've got a lot of rebuilding that has to be done, a lot of economic stipulation that needs to be carried out. And for example, one of the things the article covers is that you've got a lot of civilians driving around in cars that still have blown out windows. So, you know, we're definitely not there yet. But this is obviously an important first step. So the big question that we're going to focus on today is the future and what's next. The good news is always good, but it's staying good is what we're most interested in. And one of the biggest things, one of the biggest hurdles yet to face, actually the two things that you could argue are tied, are first and foremost, we've got the potential and the almost certain likelihood of a Kurdish referendum that could occur, and basically a cry or a plea or a demand, depending on how you want to look at it, for the Kurds to have their own state, not part of Iraq. And then you've also got the ongoing issue of the Syrian civil war, which, believe it or not, has a major effect. The whole reason that Mosul first fell is because the Islamic State poured over into the area and took over. So there's a whole lot of stuff going on. This is certainly not the end of the line, a good piece of news, but we want to talk about the Kurdish referendum first and foremost. And this is an area where I always think it's a difficult topic because Cam and I have discussed a number of times on this show, here in the United States and around the world, whether or not specific groups of people should generally associate with each other and desire to live with each other, or whether or not they should want to live amongst people of other beliefs and ideals. And that is kind of the fundamental question at play here, is Iraq was ultimately formulated after the aftermath of World War I, and was really a political assembly of territory that didn't really involve the wishes of the people in the area, or not, you know, as most of them would tell you, it did not involve what they wanted. So there's that. I mean, you have to consider that these people were never really given the option in the first place. And second of all, they don't like each other very well, and they don't have a good history of getting along. And you're trying to put multiple different religious groups, sects, whatever you want to call them, under the same body of government, which for ones that are as founded in their principles as these, has not proven to be very successful. So the question is, do you think a Kurdish referendum, a peaceful separation of some of Iraq's land dedicated to the Kurdish people, would be a good idea or not? If we were going to boil it down to, you know, simplifying the idea of separating them out from Iraq,
I mean,
which is what they want.
Yeah.
They're expecting a resounding yes if the referendum vote is had.
Right, which they won't get. I mean, we see this time and time again in this region. We've obviously got the Israelites and Palestine having these disputes, especially over the Holy Land. But you see this as well in Iraq. I think that the discussion should be had. I'm not too terribly sure whether it's a go or not. I think there are too many questions to be answered. I know they would like northern Iraq, but that could be misconstrued to be a lot of different things. Is it the, you know, northern tip? Is it the northern half? Is it the northern quarter? What are we talking about here? How many cities? How much oil? How much, you know, of these things would they own?
There's a lot of considerations.
Yeah, there's a lot of considerations. So I'm not going to just say, yes, it should happen. I think the discussion should happen, yes. I think any group of people, especially one, and in the Middle East, I think it's very plain to see that a lot of these people didn't have a choice. But another thought creeps into my mind, and it says, well, I mean, I didn't have a choice that where I currently live in Cincinnati is Ohio and not Kentucky. So if I gather enough people, can I just, you know, say screw Ohio and millions of people in Cincinnati should be able to become part of Kentucky if we wanted to be? Like that's what it becomes too messy and too dicey, I think, if you just allow if you give these out left and right, where say hypothetically a group of 50,000 people would want a small town in Ohio to become their own sovereign nation, and they would have the right to do that if America is going around saying, yes, you can do this in other countries, but no, we can't do it in this country. Which, I mean, we've got rules for secession and sure, things like that for states, but that's pretty much what you're saying.
You also have to think about, though, too, I mean, because that was exactly the direction that I was headed next, was to talk about, you know, is it fair for us to not say that they have that opportunity? But they also are in a situation where they had no say in the formation of the country that they currently live in. I mean, for all intents and purposes, they really didn't have.
Neither did I.
Well, but you currently have a say in how it will be divided. And I think there is something certainly to be said for their ongoing and continual pleas and cries for help to the world of saying this government does not do a good job of representing all the people of Iraq. Because it just can't, because it is so diverse and the ideologies are so different amongst some of the people that there's just not a good way to do that. Now, you could argue the same thing for certain people here in the U.S., of course, but the difference is, obviously, we've got a nation where, you know, people don't drive around with blown out car windows. That's not the majority of people. We do have a nation where if you want to move from Cincinnati, you know, across the country and live in Los Angeles, you can do that. Now, it might take some financial means to do that, but at the end of the day, the government, nobody else is going to prevent, you're not going to lose your life doing that. You don't risk your life by moving across the country. You know, there's not a reasonable expectation any more so than your everyday life.
But I would say that most of that is not a governmental issue. I would say most of that is a terrorist, you know, another country invading them issue.
Well, sure.
Which I think if the Kurdish all gathered together would become even more of an issue because they would be able to be targeted.
Right. But that's also the concept of if people are opting out of protection, that's a debate that, you know, the U.S. has faced many a times abroad is do we force our protection upon people who may or may not want our protection? You know, well, we're going, you know, for example, to come to Iraq and Afghanistan, and it doesn't really matter whether or not those countries want us there because we're coming, and that's just how it is, and we're going to make your nations better, and it doesn't matter if you didn't think they were broken, you know, but we're going to fix them. And I think that that's something, I think there's something to be said for the discussion has to be had, and it has to be had in such a way where there's an actual mindset of the people having the conversation that there is a possibility of doing something for the Kurdish people that satisfies them, that they can be happy with. And that could be anything from, you know, exactly what they want to something else that they're willing to compromise on. But I think that a real intent and the mindset of the people being in the right place is critical, because just having the discussion is something that's been done, you know, however many times. The UN's great at talking about things. They like to talk
and asking for support for 700,000 people who are displaced.
Exactly. But at the end of the day, you have people, you know, who are suffering every day in these conflicts, while the people who haven't suffered a day in their life are sitting around discussing how to take care of those people. And I think there is something to note there, the hypocrisy of the issue at hand, when the people who are actually in the situation don't have a voice to resolve the situation. And they're at the mercy of people who, you know, have never once and will never set foot in that country, and will never, you know what it's like to not have their voice heard, because that's just the position they've been in. So I think that that's important. I don't know. I agree with you. There's lots of, obviously, complications and things that go into what it would mean to separate territory from Iraq. But if the Iraq people as a whole want that, and I think part of why they've, heard that there will be a resounding yes if the vote is had, is because people who aren't Kurdish are fine with the Kurds having their own area. You know, they don't want them to be part of their area anyway. So it's advantageous to them to, you know, pose the same vote. It has more to do with the political pressures outside the country, you know, the U.S. and others, who don't support it for political reasons and the headaches that it poses, than the people inside the country. And that's where I think the issue lies, more than what Iraq decides to do. You know, if the people of Iraq decide that's what they want to do, great. I think they ought to be allowed to do that. And I don't think it's our place, since we've allegedly turned over the security of the nation to them, to, you know, step in and say, well, that's a nice idea, but we're not going to actually let you do that, you know, or we're not going to support you anymore if you do that, which is the same thing as basically, you know, saying,
yeah,
you can't do that.
It's the old ultimatum trick, where the ultimatum is just, oh, well, you die.
Right.
You either do this or you die. Right. We're not going to force you to do it. We're giving you a choice.
Yeah. We're giving you a choice.
Or you suffer severely.
That's right. Yeah. Where eventually the nation crumbles, which it may do anyway, even with our support. Because depending on the results of this, you could be right back to what you see in Syria, which is a civil war. Mm-hmm. Obviously for different reasons, but in many ways for similar reasons. And I think that that's worth noting, that now may not be the perfect time to have this discussion, right after we're trying to rebuild and revitalize, but there's never going to be a perfect time. And at some point, the Kurds are not going to, you know, they're not going to be okay waiting any longer. They're going to say enough's enough, and now we're going to do something
what we want to do.
Right. Which is basically, for different reasons, pretty much the same thing that happened in Syria. You know, there was enough people that said enough is enough. We're not willing to wait or have dialogue anymore, because that's not addressing what we feel is important. So I guess the final point there is, I guess it's different in my mind. Obviously, if Camden isn't happy living in Cincinnati, Camden can easily, and has, you know, and may even be encouraged in some situations economically, to move. But it's not that easy for people in the Middle East, who there's not really any place to go, because there's a limited number of countries that will take them. And even of the countries that will take them, finding work, a stable job, or even anybody who, you know, can speak your language on a daily basis is a challenge. And that's not something that we as Americans think about. If Camden moves from Cincinnati to Los Angeles, he's not going to have to worry about whether or not he can find somebody that speaks English. You know, he's not going to have to worry about. Yeah, I mean, you might run into some people who don't, but 99% of everybody you run into is going to be able to speak your language, or enough of it that they can communicate.
And the Western dialect, man. I tell you what.
Yeah.
I have to pick that up.
Yeah.
Bro.
It'll make it real rough. But you won't have to worry about, you know, getting car bombed on the way there.
That's very true.
Or running into a civil war zone, mm-hmm. or God knows what else.
I'll probably have to look up the definition of cowabunga if they still, they still do that out there.
Yeah. That might be the extent.
That's
of it.
Deal breaker right there, though.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is the Syria issue, and whether or not peace in Iraq is even possible with that. But we're going to talk about that in just a moment. And before we do, we're going to take a quick break, And remind you that new episodes of The State of Us are available every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday by 6 p.m. Eastern Time. True Chat will be the mortal enemy of speculation, innuendo, and stagnation. We will champion informed opinions and fresh ideas. True Chat will prove that media can be trusted, relied on, and responsible. We won't join the media elite because we're setting a new standard, a higher standard, the True Chat standard. To ensure that this show maintains the highest of ethical standards, we make it easy for you to voice any concerns with today's episode by emailing ethics@truechat.org. Again, that's ethics@truechat.org. And the show of the week, Cam,
is
the True Chat Show.
It is.
So you should check it out. By the time you're listening to this, the True Chat Show will be available. So make sure to tune in every Monday through Friday. That's every day.
Every weekday, baby.
That's every weekday. That's right. So tune in. It's a good time. Cam and I don't know what we'll talk about, but we'll always talk about something. And most of the time, it'll be somewhat interesting to certain people.
Yeah, from the read I wrote, it's from the read that I wrote.
Yeah, from the read I
happy,
wrote.
Happy, sad, prophetic, or just plain weird. That was those are your four options.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's about it.
That's about it.
But it covers a wide range.
It covers most things under the sun.
Yeah.
So beyond the sun, well, actually, it covers a lot of things beyond the sun.
I'd say we both thought to be very prophetic on that show.
Yes. Yes. Prophetic.
Mm.
Great.
Good word. I like it.
So turning our attention back to the issue at hand.
Oh yeah.
The Syrian Civil
War. Time
to
get sad again.
Yeah. Well, hopefully. I mean, like I said, we let off with the good.
Moving in the right direction.
That's
though.
Right. We'll take one step at a time.
A victory in Mosul is, a victory in the Syrian Civil War.
Well,
the,
you should be thrilled, too, ISIS. That the truce that Trump announced at the G20 summit has survived its first day.
Nice.
We got one whole 24-hour period
go.
Under our belt.
Let's go. And if it's still surviving right now at 3:38 p.m. Eastern time while we're hanging out here, it's probably another 6 or so hours.
That's right.
I don't know how they're factoring that Iraq time, but hey.
Going on day two.
Yeah, let's go.
It's intense. So the second issue here is the Syrian Civil War. And the here's a direct quote. This is from the New York Times again, same article. "Forget Kurdistan," said Masoud Rezani, the chancellor of the Kurdistan Region Security Council and the area's top intelligence official. Quote, "Is the rest of Iraq united? Even the Arabs in Iraq are not united." He continued, "We are not the reason Iraq is falling apart. I think Iraq is a fabricated state. It was built on the wrong foundations. And then there is Syria, the civil war across the border. As much as the sectarian policies of the former prime minister, Nouri Kamal al-Makali, helped the Islamic State regenerate in Iraq after its predecessor, al-Qaeda in Iraq, was largely eradicated, the group was able to expand into Syria before sweeping across the border in 2014 and taking Mosul. Without peace in Syria, officials say there is little chance of peace and stability in Iraq." And that's what we're looking at right now. The whole reason that Mosul fell in the first place is because of instability in Syria. And that's, you know, Iraq doesn't have the greatest army, military, etc. It just doesn't, because they're not that experienced. They're not that old. And we've, as the United States, we've done, you know, pretty much most of what we can do, but there is only so much we can do without directly being there and without directly controlling it, which we've now given up. And they're working hard to maintain peace in their own country, let alone having to worry about defending their borders against the Islamic State, which they've proven they can do, but it's at great cost, both human lives and monetarily and economically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, the big risk. So I think the larger issue we have to look at is there really any way that you or I foresee peace in Iraq without also fixing and establishing peace in Syria?
No, I don't see peace for the Middle East without intervention in the Syrian Civil War. And I think we've both talked about that multiple times. Is Trump's ceasefire is, I think, is a good thing. As I said last week on one of our shows. I thought it was a good move, a good step forward. Justin obviously disagreed with me, but hey, we're going one day strong, apparently, according to the article there.
That's right.
So I think that conflict needs to be stopped, and ISIS needs to be, and I hate the word eradicated, because I am one of the strongest believers in you can't eradicate an idea. There will be people who believe in the ISIS cause. But the demilitarization, if you will, of ISIS is something that needs to be accomplished to the greatest extent that we can before we see real peace and real, I guess, peace of mind in the region. Because that's what a lot of these countries need, especially Iraq. There, you see more of this, and you see it all around the world right now, nationalism and love for one's own group, because there is so much uncertainty, especially with groups like ISIS and civil wars like Syria. And that's just a double whammy for a neighbor like Iraq, who's also dealing with their own ISIS problem, mostly dealt with, but still dealing with remnants, and has about three groups that hate each other, probably a couple more that aren't as prominent as the Shiite, the Sunnis, and the Kurds.
If we can, for a moment, I'd like to open it up a little bit further and talk about, because there's a lot of discussion about what is the solution to all of this. And I think in discussing the solution, we must first understand the nature of the problem, because a lasting solution is not possible unless we first recognize and figure out how to fix or avoid what caused the problem in the first place. And the militarization of the entire area, I think, is obviously a huge part of it. When these groups have access and the ability to fight one another on a grand scale in the way that they are, with machine guns and vehicles and, in some cases, you know, planes and all kinds of stuff, that definitely escalates things as to where, you know, if the most you can do is walk down the street and stab a few people, obviously that's still terrible and awful, but that's a lot different than riding on the back of a Humvee with a machine gun and mowing down 50 people or 100, or launching biological weapons and wiping out entire cities.
Correct.
Those are obviously just different in nature. One is a police issue. The other one is a war. And that's where I think we have to look at the nature of the issue. And in looking at that, I wanted to ask you, not to minimize what's happening, but do you find the nature of what they are fighting about, depending on what you view what they're fighting about, to be somewhat naive or silly, to use a less intellectual word? Do you find it to be preposterous that they're fighting about over who should control, for example, the Holy Land, or what government should be in charge, or in the Iraq case, whether or not we should have our own territory and what that territory should be? Do you find many of those things to be, from an American standpoint, a odd thing to do in the 21st century? How you resolve these
things. You gave
things.
Me four different words there, and all of them have a slightly different answer for
I'm
me.
I'm trying to keep it open for you to take it whatever direction you want.
My initial answer is no. I don't think so. I think you've got people who are parts of similar but different long-standing religions. I mean, it's about the same as the difference between a Catholic and a Protestant kind of deal.
But Catholics and Protestants don't, most of them, don't take up arms and fight one another.
They did.
Sure, but not now.
Well, you're right. But I don't think that makes it odd or naive. I think that area,
because that would be concerning if that happened here in the U.S., obviously.
Right.
If the Catholics down the street took up arms one day and marched down the street and started, you know, attacking the Baptists, that would not be acceptable.
Waging war on the Baptist church.
And that would seem totally insane for something like that to occur.
Right. I would say it's very obvious that the Middle East as a whole, that area of the world, if you look at history and you look at the things that Christians have done in the past, and now it seems to be continuing in that area, that it they're moving a little slower than the rest of the world is to...
Well, they're less developed.
Get to, absolutely, to get to the point where most of the first world has gotten to, which is, okay, you practice your religion, I practice mine, and the most you get is the racist minority of this country, or the prejudiced minority of this country, I should say, spewing words back and forth, and very select groups going after people. You don't see, you know, all-out war being waged.
Because there is violence.
And I think that's where we're at. I don't think that makes it odd or makes them naive in any way. I just think they're less developed as an area, as a geographic area, and that's why you still see fights based on these, what seems to some Americans as very base reasons to fight about something.
Right. Something that we would never physically take up arms to fight about here in the U.S.
Most of us, yes.
Right. Again, not that we like to talk in generalizations, but for the sake of this, it's important to do so, because 99% of Americans... Right. Are not going to attack their neighbor just because...
Put whatever percentage you have on it, that's not 100%. And yeah. I'd probably think, yeah, you're pretty close.
Because there's always, and that's part of the concept that you and I think are both very strong on, is you cannot kill a concept. It just can't be done. An ideology, a belief, you cannot totally eradicate those things.
Because especially if that belief gains you something,
right?
Power,
because
weapons,
of that, in
food.
What's arguably the most advanced nation in the world, the United States, there are still people who will do that, unfortunately. And of course, they always make news. But there is almost certainly strong, immediate, widespread condemnation of those actions by society, the leaders, the politicians, everybody. Everybody says that's wrong, and there's no discussion or debate about, you know, should they have done that thing. It's no, we don't live in a world where you disagree with somebody, so you shoot them. That's not where we live.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you for what it's worth, 100%, in terms of if we're just going to use a real simple scale of advancement on a 0 to 100 scale, the United States is an 85, you know, out of actualizing itself as, you know, peaceful and mundane and intellectual and educated and all that good stuff, economically prosperous. We'll just call it an 85, you know, and everybody else
comparatively
is below that.
Yeah.
Right. There's still room to grow, but we're pretty high up there. So we're an 85, just for sake of argument. There, and it's taken us all of our whatever, you know, 200 and some odd years to get to where we are. So that's where we're at. They have been around longer, but proportionally speaking, they're probably at a 20 or 30.
But that area of the world has been in conflict and in rebuild for almost its entire existence.
Exactly. And they do make some progress, but it's slower. It's taken them 4 or 5 times, if not 10 times longer, to get to 30, from 0 to 30, you know? And here we are, and we've done it in... again, our 200 and some odd years to get to an 85. But you also have to think about the U.S. was founded by people who were specifically seeking to avoid that very thing. They wanted to avoid tyranny, and they wanted to avoid religious oppression, primarily. Mm-hmm. They wanted to have freedom. So when you bring together those people with the initial concept and everybody's starting on the same page...
Yeah.
It's a whole different ballgame.
And what's the initial concept of the Middle East, of that area? And I'd say it's not,
you'd
we want
get 20
peace
different answers
for everyone. Yeah, well, you'd get 20 different answers, but if I had to give you one, it's, no, I don't want those people to worship the way they do. I want everyone to worship the way I do. Or right. I want everyone to believe in the same type of religion or ideology or morality that I do.
Right. And then you do have the more educated individuals, which you could argue in the Syrian civil war is exactly what's happening. Or in Egypt, that was another excellent example of an uprising by the people where they said, we want, you know, we have come to the realization that we want freedom, we want a voice, and we don't want to fight over these things anymore. But in order to get there, we have to be willing, like the United States did over 200 years ago, to stand up and do whatever it takes to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because how did we get our freedom? We fought a war.
Yeah, we fought for it.
You know, and we fought again and again for that freedom, which is unfortunate.
So did you not just answer your own question there?
Well,
isn't that what these people are fighting for?
Right.
They're in their own...
They are fighting for their version of... what's right. You know, for us, what's right is freedom and the ability to worship or to share your opinions and viewpoints without the fear of death.
And to be represented.
Right. And to be represented. All without the fear of dying for those things. We have laws and structure, etc. I think the last thing that I wanted to ask you was, because I was planning to answer that one, but what I'm interested in is the rest of the world, countries like the United States, that have made it to this point of we don't kill each other over these things, do we have a, I don't know if societal is the right word, maybe just a human responsibility to fellow mankind to get the thing resolved in a way that moves them forward based off of our own experience having been there and gone through that? Does the rest of the world, I'm not talking United States playing
global. No one else
is going to
do anything.
I'm just saying, does the rest of the world have a responsibility, or is this one of those things that the only way to get through it is to let them go through it? There is no other way for us, even if we don't know what that is, there's just no other way other than for them to do it, to fight it out, and to figure it out on their own. The rest of the world can't actually do anything that would end it permanently or as permanent can be.
I have a question for you before I answer. Did you just call America Globocop?
Yes.
All right. That's great. Did you make that up?
No.
Okay. Sadness.
I did.
Because I was like, man, that was really creative.
Yes. No. I wish I could take credit for that, but I cannot.
Darn it. Globocop is super good.
Globocop. So yeah, this is not a question of whether or not America should be Globocop. It's about the countries that have progressed to a point where that's not what we fight over anymore.
Right.
Physically fight over.
And no, I don't think we can. I mean, no one... And people helped us. We had allies, sure. But trying to force them to do it is not something that's worked. I mean, all you have to do is look at history.
I also think... You could also argue, though, that...
We did it the wrong way.
Right. We didn't ask them what they wanted. We said, here's what we believe is best. I mean, for example, what if the world, the United Nations, decided that what was going to happen is, you know, the entire Middle East, we are going to restructure and rebuild effective immediately. And whether or not they like it, that's too bad, because the rest of the world could, you know, annihilate them. I don't know, 100, 1,000 times over if they wanted to. And what we're going to do is hold, you know, an international election in everything that's considered the Middle East on a vote of how to separate everything. And obviously there's tons of logistics that go into that, but it'd be a supervised and militarized election overseen by forces not from within the Middle East, allowing the people to actually vote on how the thing should be split up. You know, and provide them three or four.
In a perfect world, sure. But
three or four scenarios.
My lord, how would you organize that? Who would run? Do you just get to vote for anyone? Like, does everybody get to vote? I wouldn't even know what the rules or where to begin on that
right.
would be.
Everybody in the Middle East has a vote. And, I mean, you know, again, I don't want to get into the weeds on this. There's tons of logistics that would have to be figured out. But
right. We don't have to get into the weeds.
Assuming that it's possible to hold a vote for the people in the Middle East and present them with, I don't know whether it's 3 or 30 scenarios of how to split this thing up, let them vote on that, you know, and again, whatever wins popular support is the separation that's gone with. And then in those areas, you hold continued supervised elections of how they will establish their own governments. They will vote on, we're going to have a dictatorship, or we're going to have a democracy.
See, but this isn't how anyone has ever made a country or a government ever.
Right. And it's gone super well in the past, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's gone really well. America's best country in the world.
That's right. We only had to kill millions of people to get here.
Eh, you know, so did everybody else, I guess. We had like what? How many people were in the first Continental Congress? 20 some odd?
I don't know.
30 some odd? Yeah. They're the ones that made America. Now look at us. It's never going to be a full person direct democracy thing. That's a...
I don't think it should be.
You don't put that... You don't... This is going to sound bad, but you don't put that kind of power and that kind of deep critical thinking on the whole of society, on the whole of a population.
Right.
That's too much to work through. Who's going to write it? Because then you've got people also, you know, hiding things inside the legislation. I don't know. I think that's too much. I think it's too big to even be realized in a hypothetical scenario.
So better to let them fight it out.
Yeah, better to let them advance as naturally as it is. I still think we should stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons. I still think a civil war in Syria constitutes our help. But when it comes to Iraq trying to make its own country, trying to separate, when it comes from Kurds to Sunnis to Shiites, however they want to split that up eventually, that's got to be them. Helping people out of a military, you know, a military struggle like the Syrian civil war is something that I don't think hinders their development at all.
Well, except obviously we have to make a decision about who we're backing, which then in turn is our continued meddling in the affairs of...
Yeah, but we're not going to back the terrorists.
Other nations. Well, sure, but in Syria you've got multiple forces at play.
I understand.
You don't. It's not just a matter of terrorists versus not terrorists. You've got terrorists versus government versus the rebels.
You're going to tell me Assad's not a terrorist after he gasses all of his own people? Or most of his own people?
But that again is, you know, our interpretation as the United States.
Okay.
Right. Who are we to say that a sovereign nation doesn't have...
Who's breaking international law.
...the authority to do that, of which they didn't volunteer to subject themselves to. Which goes again to, you know, well, we're going to force... Cuba's not part of the United Nations until they're violating international law, and then, by God, we're going to punish them for it, even though they don't actually have a voice in the first place in the, you know, creation of international law. But they're doing something wrong. I'm not arguing morally or higher than that, ethically, that these things are wrong. I'm saying that we have made those determinations in many of these situations without them having the opportunity to decide whether or not they submit themselves to our interpretation.
Buck's
got to
stop somewhere on some of that stuff. And the atrocities that have been committed by Assad are not...
And it stops at Global Cop US.
In this
situation.
Yes. I think eventually it does. Because no one else wants to go and risk their own butt. They expect the US to do it. Everyone else can condemn it all they want, but no one else is going to send troops. I mean, we haven't seen it in the past 2 decades.
Does that make us morally superior to those other nations?
No, it makes us willing to get it done.
I mean, not that willing to get it done and morally superior are exclusive of each other. They could both be the same thing.
Sure, but I think the morals of other countries are very clear when they, you know, come out and condemn these actions, but that doesn't mean in any means that they would send troops.
Actions speak louder than words, though, right?
Sure.
So, you know.
But when you're talking about morals, I don't think we, you know, you don't weigh morals, I don't think. Your morals are your morals.
Well, that's...
Most of the time for people, most of them are absolute.
Do you value...
Very few exceptions.
Right. Do you value freedom? You, Camden.
Me? Yeah. Yes.
Are you willing to die for freedom?
Sure.
Okay, then you value it. You know, but that's the easiest universal test of, do you actually care about something? Do you care about it enough to risk your life for it? No? Then you probably don't have any business speaking up about it in the first place, because that's what happens with the rest of the world is
then for me, it's easy for me to say that
Big Brother US will take care of it. And yet they're quick to condemn any time that we misstep. And I think that's part of where you end up where we are in this very conflict of hypocrisy that just continually circles. The rebels think the government's wrong, and the government thinks the rebels shouldn't have a voice, and neither of them are right. Obviously, you have the right, we believe, to change your government. But I think that there's a lot that goes into it, and we have to be careful as the U.S. about what our end game is, and I think that's what's still unclear. So if there was one thing I'd take away from all of it, is that as long as we're going to be involved and people like Camden and Justin are going to discuss this, we need to figure out what we want in the end. Is it just to end the Syrian civil war? Is it for peace in the Middle East? Because those are different.
Of course.
They're not the same. And they never have been. You know, same thing with, we've got all these little agendas. You know, Iran. Well, no nuclear weapons for them. You know, end the Syrian civil war. Help Iraq get on its feet. It doesn't seem like we ever take into account that so many of those things are interdependent on each other. And that's the one thing out of all of this that I would like to see us change, because so much of this, as we've identified, is not on the U.S. specifically, is to decide what we're going for. Because I think if you ask the everyday American, they probably can't tell you what the agenda is.
If you ask Donald Trump, can he tell you?
Oh, probably not.
All right. That's probably why.
Do you think he could?
No, I'm saying that's probably why the average American can't tell you.
If you were locked in a room with Donald Trump and he knew it would be totally anonymous and he could tell you the absolute truth, and you asked him, you know, what's the plan for the Middle East?
I'm sure he'd give me something.
But do you think that there's been any indication that that plan has a real end goal to it, as opposed to here's how we're going to handle it, but there's not really any direction that we're trying to go. We just want to look like we're doing something, and hopefully that something has a positive benefit.
That's what it looks like right now, yes.
Right. And I mean, I'm not, you know, absolving the previous administration of anything either, because
their strategy sucked too.
I think our Middle East policy has been pretty much down the tube for forever. So there really hasn't been a policy is kind of the problem.
At least about 6 years, I'd say.
Right. Because, I mean, the closest thing we've had to a policy is don't interfere except maybe if and when we feel bad enough to intervene, which really isn't a policy.
And then we're going to tell them we're taking troops out, and then we don't take them out, and then we do kind of take them out, but not really all the way. And
then it takes another 5 years before we turn over security of the country.
And then that goes really poorly.
Right, and then we've got advisors there who are, you know, again, air quote advisors, but they sometimes kind of fight, so, but we won't really cover that because they're not supposed to. So, I mean, just a whole
They're defending themselves.
That would be the biggest thing I think that first and foremost the U.S. can do. If everybody out there listening wants something to happen in the Middle East, what I think you need to call for is for our government to figure out what that thing is, you know, because that's first and foremost is you can't solve the problem if you don't know what the problem is. And I don't think we have a clear focus on what the problem is or what we want to do about it.
And being strong on ISIS is not a plan.
No, that's not a plan.
It's a talking point.
Yep, we don't like
ISIS.
It's
how you get elected.
Let's protect us against ISIS. Great. What does that mean? What does that look like? Let's tell us, you know? So that's where we'll leave it. Important stuff. But good news. I want to highlight again, good news, you know, step in the right direction, right? One day of a ceasefire, that's good news. It probably won't have any lasting effect, but hey, it's one day where people aren't dying.
That's subjective.
That is.
But yes.
Well, it's a fact that it's one day where people aren't dying. So that's good. Dying for military reasons.
You know what I meant.
I know. But nonetheless, we'll leave it up to you to contemplate and decide what you think the U.S. should be doing in the Middle East. What should our end goal be? Before we get out of here, if you haven't already, make sure to download TrueChat's mobile app or visit our website, Cam's favorite place to listen, truechat.org, TrueChat.org. Our network offers an amazing lineup of shows on sports and politics, entertainment, business, a lifestyle, and more, so make sure to explore what True Chat has to offer. For the state of us on True Chat, broadcasting from Studio 2A in Cincinnati, Ohio, I'm Justin T. Weller.
And I'm Cam Pierce.
As always, thank you very much for tuning in. We'll see you next time on The State of Us. Be the change.